countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
Last year, meat sales fell by 184 million quid, so a lot less of us are eating meat. And part of this is due to the rise in veganism and campaigns such as Meat Free Monday and, how do you say this?
Veganuary.
Veganuary.
I think that
which
sounds
is
it.
Which is not January.
I've been doing all right, but I ain't gonna stop till I get where I wanna be. Let's sit down and lay it all out, cause I wanna make proper pee.
For most of us, veganism is a relatively new phenomenon, ideology, or fad, depending on your viewpoint.
Brand new whip that's out of this world like Spaceship Odyssey. Everything green and that on my vegan chat, yeah man, eat broccoli. Gotta look after yourself nowadays, family, and I do that properly. Gotta keep your eyes on the property, yeah, I'm a proper G, no one's stopping me.
But in fact, it was in 1944 when an English school teacher called Donald Watson came up with the word to describe the non-consumption of animal-sourced food and products.
Donald Watson, born in 1910, is credited with first coining the term vegan.
If you eat it for animal reasons, like he did, Donald Watson did, if you eat a vegan diet for health reasons, like Donald Watson also did, if you eat it for the environment or any other reason, which Watson also did, you can call yourself a vegan. You don't have to be eating just for one reason to do that.
We have been putting things off year after year. This is an urgent problem that has to be solved.
While animal welfare may have been the original motivator for going vegan, the climate emergency of the 21st century is the catalyst to the recent rapid growth in veganism.
Not even a week into 2020, and already this is a year no Australian will forget.
This is illustrated best in Veganuary, which began with 3,000 signatories in 2014. This year, Veganuary has almost 400,000 people signed up globally, with almost 6,000 in Ireland taking part. As Green Corps Chief Patrick Coveney told this programme last year, the trend towards meatless, plant-based and free from is forcing food companies to sit up and take notice.
And about a third of all of the new product introductions that we've done are either fully vegan products or products that are have some, you know, very significant free-from component. So if you go back 3-5 years, this was all about animal welfare. But actually, most of the consumer research on this now suggests that that's only about a third of why people are buying these products. A big part of it is around climate change, and a big part of it is about a perception of health.
Another illustration of the growth, albeit from a very small base, of veganism came earlier this month when a UK employment tribunal ruled that veganism is indeed a philosophical and religious belief receiving protection under the Equality Act 2010. This means ethical vegans will receive protection from discrimination.
Veganism is a philosophical belief, and when you look at my life and anybody else's life that is an ethical vegan, you will see it. You don't have to dig too deep. You will see how it affects on everybody's life and how important and how respectful it is for the world. And this is a positive belief.
According to Bord Bia, plant-powered dietary lifestyles are more prevalent among younger generations, more urban dwellers, and among higher social grades. But not everybody, including chef Richard Corrigan, is buying in to this vegan ideology.
By the way, there's room for us all. Once you just jump pamphlets into my door to tell me about Vegan January, I don't want to know about it, I'll be honest with you. I never want to hear about it. I issued a press release saying we won't be taking part in it. So, you know what I mean?
You don't like veganism?
No, I don't, because it's just been shouted at us from every avenue and every paper, every magazine, every news outlet. I'm just hearing about Vegan January. Every, you know, just coming at me like a big, big mountain, you know. I really, the only mountain I want to see is just sirloins and ribeyes and fillets, you know. Yeah.
So, how do we feed a growing global population from a dwindling land base in a safe, sustainable and environmentally friendly manner, which also provides livestock farmers with a viable future? Is veganism and plant-based one answer to tackling global warming? Is flexitarianism a more realistic way forward for all? And how can farmers and environmentalists work together rather than against each other in providing the world with safe, sustainable and affordable food into the future? This morning on Countrywide, we'll try to address some of the issues, myths and facts which pertain. And with me in studio, Professor Peter Thorne, NUI Maynooth, an international panel on climate change. Professor Alice Stanton, Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland and a director at Devenish Nutrition. Brian Rush, who's a farmer from Kildare and the deputy president-elect of the IFA. And Catherine Cleary, restaurant critic with the Irish Times and a food writer as well. And in our Galway studio, JP McMahon, author, chef and restaurateur as well. You can text 51551, tweet at RTE Countrywide, and email countrywide@rte.ie. But first, what is it like to be a vegan? Brenda Donoghue went along to one of the growing number of vegan restaurants in Dublin, Kale and Coco in Stonybatter, along with 2FM DJ Keith Walsh, because Keith switched to a plant-based diet 3 years ago, and so he was right at home having breakfast in the hipster heartland of Dublin 7.
Morning. Welcome to Kale and Coco. What can I get you for breakfast?
What can you recommend?
So for breakfast, we've got our smoothie bowls, we've got porridge with a range of toppings, and we've got our smoothies and coffees as well.
So I'm looking at the Khaleesi because I'm a Game of Thrones fan. What is the Khaleesi?
The Khaleesi has got dragon fruit, so hence the name. Lots of lovely toppings like mango and banana.
We go for that, Keith?
We go for the Khaleesi. Well, I was going to ask for the mushroom latte, yes.
I'll just have a regular one.
Sure, you don't want the mushroom, Brenda?
No.
It will be made with oat milk, though.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, Brent.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. We sit down?
Thanks.
So how long are you a vegan, Keith?
Well, I would describe it, first of all, as I eat a plant-based diet. Because I think that vegan kind of puts people off. And as you say, even as you're saying vegan, like, people are already getting annoyed listening to the radio and throwing things at the radio. I'd say plant-based. I eat a plant-based diet.
So how long, though?
3 years.
3 years, yeah. Okay.
My father, at the age of 40, had a heart attack. So when I was approaching that age, I thought, I need to look into this. Probably spent most of my 20s and 30s not looking after myself. Towards the end of my 30s, I started getting into more physical activity, working out. And a big part of getting fit, and the kids would say getting ripped and having muscles, is protein. So I would have gone on this fitness journey, which included eating a lot of meat. Chicken breasts for me breakfast, chicken breasts for me lunch, chicken breasts for me tea.
Protein shakes and
protein shakes, protein bars, the whole lot. And I went the whole nine yards for about a year on the meat. And when I got to the end of that, I didn't particularly feel good. I felt worse. Even though I looked amazing, I felt worse than I did when I wasn't healthy. I was ripped, but I didn't feel better.
Yeah.
So I needed to look at that, and I needed to find the diet that would suit me. And that's where I came up with plant-based, you know.
How old were you then when your dad had a heart attack?
I was very young, but the thing was, when I approached the age he had the heart attack, which was 39, 40, that's when I started thinking about it.
What's your dad's name? I know he survived.
Yes.
Tell me how he is now.
Mick Walsh is 80. He just turned 80, so he's doing great. I mean, but he changed. When he had the heart attack, he had to change. I wanted to change before I had the heart attack. He changed afterwards. So he changed what he ate. He changed his activity and all that kind of stuff. And now he's a hale and hearty 80, which is unbelievable.
Was it a learning curve for you to start off cooking? And, you know, what were the first meals you cooked?
So I went to the Happy Pair. You know the Happy Pair, the two lads? And I got one of their books. But what I ended up doing for a long time, they have this bean burrito that they make. I had a lot of bean burritos because I had one recipe and I liked it, and I knew how to make it, and it was quick. It was kind of refried beans, and there was not, wasn't much to it, a couple of tins of beans and a bit of guacamole or whatever, and it was very simple, and I ate a lot of bean burritos. Slowly but surely, I started introducing different dishes to my repertoire, but the bean burrito got me through about a year of being vegan.
We've got an oat milk latte.
That's yours.
Yeah, and the mushroom latte, and our Khaleesi smoothie bowl.
Keith, do you mind if I have a chat to the co-owners here? We have Rebecca
and
Jenny, and you are the owners of Kale and Coco, right in the middle of Stonybatter. Do you realise that less than a generation ago that this area was called Cowtown?
I actually believe this building used to be a slaughterhouse, we've been told, which is quite ironic.
Why did you start up the business here?
I think we both quit very corporate jobs around the same time and went on a big trip around the world backpacking. We both went vegan along the way, and we kind of made it our mission to go to all the best veggie and vegan restaurants that we could find. So when we came back to Ireland, we could just see that that whole world was just starting to kick off here, and we really wanted to be a part of that.
So you're both vegan, you both run a business here based on those choices. What do you love about it?
I think I love when someone comes in here who's unsure about it. They're a bit skeptical. They're not sure if they'll enjoy a vegan meal, if it's going to be filling enough for them. And I love when they turn around and say, that was delicious, that was amazing, I'll be back.
Well, listen, I better go and have my breakfast. Lovely to chat to you.
You too. Thanks so much, Brenda.
Now, you have to try the mushroom latte. Isn't that delicious?
Yeah. As vegetarianism, veganism becomes more popular, see, a lot of the fast food restaurants now have those options on their menu. Say I said to you, here is a burger. It is grass-fed, it is organic, and here is a fast food vegan burger. Which one are you going to go for?
I'm going to go for the vegan burger.
You wouldn't even go for... No.
It's not even a thing for me. I just don't eat meat, that's it. And same with milk. I don't miss it. I'm very lucky. But the thing that I do like about these places that have these meat-free burgers is that occasionally you get a craving for something that's not really good for you, and it's nice to be able to do that every now and then.
So Keith, how have you and how has your life changed since you decided to go on a plant-based diet?
I haven't had a cold in a long time. I haven't missed a day of work sick in a long time. I haven't been to a doctor in over 3 years. I'm very lucky. I'm not saying that's directly, I'm just saying that these are the facts. I feel like I sleep better.
Now, can I get you anything else?
Is it a bit early for dessert, Keith?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe we could chance one, could we?
We see your dessert menu.
So we don't actually have paper menus. We try to be as paperless as possible in here. Yeah. But we do have some lovely desserts. We've got some banana bread. We've got Snickers dates, which are really popular.
Snickers at this time.
Keith, you've brought me to the other side, the vegan side, that is.
Thank goodness. Welcome, Brenda. Welcome. You'll never look back.
And that was Brenda Donoghue and Keith Walsh having breakfast there at Kale and Coco in what was formerly known as Cowtown, believe it or not, which of course is Stony Batter in Dublin. My guests are all here and have been listening to that. You're all very welcome. Thanks very much for getting up early on Saturday to join us. Peter Thorne, if I can go to you first. If we want to do our bit for the planet, how is processed plant-based and this lab-manufactured food with all the air miles involved, how is that a better option than locally produced animal protein?
So you have to look at the lifetime carbon emissions, the carbon intensity of the food. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recently produced a special report on climate change and land, actually asked for by the Irish government, amongst others. And they made the point that we do need to make a more flexitarian diet, not vegan, but flexitarian, and that we need to think about the carbon intensity of our food. And unfortunately, ruminants, sheep and cattle, are amongst the most intensive. Generally, it is less energy intensive to produce fruit and vegetables, grains, pulses. And the food mile aspect is intuitively quite big, but actually when you look at it scientifically, quantitatively, it's a very minor part. The major part of the carbon budget of any food type is its production, not its transport.
Okay, so that's from the perspective there of the environment. We might talk about the dietary element of it in a moment. But JB McMahon, you're in our Galway studio. It's a conversation I had with you before Christmas, which prompted this morning's programme, so we can all blame you. As a chef and restaurateur, what trends are you noticing now among customers when it comes to menus?
Yeah, there are a lot more people, I suppose, seeking vegetarian and vegan food. And when I say a lot more, it's probably less than 5% in our restaurant. I mean, we don't serve a massive amount of meat in a restaurant. And I do agree, well, I'm not like, I don't agree completely with a kind of extreme veganism. I do think we need to, I suppose, eat less meat and produce less of it. But like, I do think I would agree with Richard Corrigan in the sense that like 95% of the people who come into our place are eating a varied diet, but sometimes when you look into the media, you would imagine this is much bigger than it is. And unfortunately, when you want to talk about it, and this goes back to what the DJ said is about plant-based, is that unfortunately the polls are very extreme, and it's very, very difficult to have a conversation in the middle. And I find that, of course, I did some work with the Happy Pair recently, and people were saying to me, why are you working with those vegans? And their guys were, their supporters were saying, why are you working with him? He's a meat eater. And I think that the difficulty, if we're going to take veganism as a philosophical belief, then it means that it needs to fit in with a whole bunch of other philosophical beliefs, and we have to step away from the kind of the extremism, because unfortunately all these things unravel when you take when you look at it perhaps scientifically, what is sentient, what is not sentient. Like, a lot of chicken manure goes into the production of vegetables. Do vegans know that? If you take that away, then you're using chemicals, using sprays. I understand about air miles, but you look at deforestation for the production of soy and wheat. There's a whole pile of issues there.
Sure. A complex web indeed. Catherine Cleary, I want to quote a piece from your contemporary renowned British food writer, Joanna Blythman, who I know you're familiar with. She wrote recently, "A worrying groupthink now grips the public narrative around what we eat. We're led to believe that unless we abandon our traditional omnivore diet, that's eating from all major food groups, including meat and dairy, the planet will crash and burn." Now, does she have a point there? Is the focus on what we're eating, is it disproportionate, really?
You know, I think there's a lot of shouting around the debate, and JP is right. You know, there are people who are very interested in starting a row, because rows, you know, people are automatically drawn to that territory sometimes. But it's not helpful with this, with food. Food is very complex. It's our biggest industry in this country. And I think the message for farming, and, you know, this idea that all of the vegan food that we'll eat will have to be shipped in from abroad. You know, farming is not just livestock farming. Mm. Farming is all kinds of farming. And we are also an island. There is enormous potential for things like seaweed farming, which could not only sequester carbon, but also provide food and fertilizer for farmers. So I think, rather than everybody climbing into their silo, and because I think the public filters that out a lot. Most people make their decisions on what they eat based on their trusted information, and their trusted information is—it's getting difficult. There's so much industry-funded scientific research. There's the, you know, my science is better than your science argument, which is going on all the time.
Yes.
And I think that, I think the general public are just turned off by that.
Yeah.
I think the simple message, and JP, you know, got it very well, is that idea that you eat less but better, and that is a hugely optimistic story for the Irish farming industry, because the less but better eating, it reconnects consumers with farmers who are farming with a responsible approach to nature and farming the ecosystem. I mean, I'm very struck by the protests and by that sense of, among farmers, that there's anxiety and sadness around farming at the moment, which it must be very difficult.
Yeah.
And I think that story has to, that's not necessarily a bleak
story. And we're going to come to that in a moment, and I have a little clip that I want to play. But Alice Stanton, if I can move to you, what should somebody doing their shopping this morning have in their supermarket trolley? How healthy are processed, plant-based processed foods, as we were talking about there, compared to local grass and meat and dairy? Now, Peter talked about the environmental benefits. What about the dietary benefits or lack of them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important part of the debate, and the message that some people have taken from the call for veganism or for a major reduction in dairy and meat is that dairy and meat are bad for human health. And that's not the whole story. In excess, all foods are bad for human health. However, eaten in moderation, about a quarter of the plate between meat and dairy is actually saves lives and reduces disease burden. So eating meat twice to five times weekly actually is better for your health than eating it once or less a week. Obviously, the data are also true for eating meat more than once a day. That is not good for your health. The big picture is that the things that are killing us and causing heart attacks, strokes and cancer are excess calories and excess salt.
And rather than excess meat, processed
foods. So right. I think we should look at, you asked me what people should be putting in their trolley. They should be putting one third fresh fruit and vegetables, one third starchy whole grain foods.
Right.
And about a quarter meat and dairy. That is not what is happening. The trolleys are filled with 50% are processed and ultra-processed foods.
And sugar.
Sugar, rich in sugar, calories and salt.
Right.
And that is very damaging for health.
Brian Rush, you've been all over the country before Christmas looking for votes, and congratulations, you're going to be the new Deputy President of the IFA. What have far... Was there much talk at these meetings, by the way, about, I suppose, the campaign for us to move away from dairy and beef farming in this country, and what are farmers saying about that?
I'd say every meeting we attended, it came up as a topic. And I suppose farmers were growing increasingly frustrated at how they felt they were being portrayed and the way the debate had become so polarised. And if you look at farmers, you know, regardless of where they are in the country, they are delivering a lot for the environment. They're adapting technology all the time. They're adapting best practice. And depending on what part of the country you're in, you know, you look at some of the marginal areas of the country, which are lower stocked. They're delivering massively for the environment, in terms of hedgerows and biodiversity, permanent pasture. Other parts of the country where maybe they're a bit more intensive, they're adapting new technologies, they're planting hedgerows, they're trying to get into DLOS, which is the environmental scheme run by the department, and that's oversubscribed. So farmers have a massive appetite here. They're very aware of the responsibilities, but they do feel that maybe they're getting unfairly tarnished. That, you know, and it's been said that some farmers feel like they're being made out to be environmental terrorists. And that's simply not the case.
Right.
Like farmers like myself and farmers throughout the country, like the number one priority we have is to hand over a viable asset for the next generation.
But is it time, though, and Catherine touched on it there, and this is the argument, is it time for farmers to look at other alternatives to beef production as part of a just rural transition, Brian?
Well, in parts of rural Ireland, there is no other option, only either livestock or sheep. Like fruit and veg in parts of the west and in parts of the Midlands, soil type just simply won't allow that. So there's livestock there turning an inedible fibre source into a very, very high quality protein. Now, I will say in terms of alternatives, there is a group of farmers out there who are growing increasingly frustrated at a lack of access to the renewable sector and things like that. And they're willing, as part of their farming enterprise, to yeah. look at that, and they want that opportunity. And farmers want to deliver on these things.
And there's a similar problem with organics. Peter, yeah. I just go to you on this. When asked, you know, well, what should 120,000 farmers do instead? You know, a lot of people that are more environmental would say, oh, grow vegetables, horticulture, grow trees. They can do that, no problem. You know, there doesn't seem to be any joined up thinking in that regard. As Brian says, that's, you know, what happens if everybody becomes a vegetable grower? What happens to that market? And you can't grow vegetables in every part of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the very first things we need is a national land use plan, which we amazingly don't have. And the point is very well made. There are areas of the country where the current is the only thing that can be done. And we can't penalise people for where they live. So we absolutely need a national land use plan. We need to work with the CAP reform to ensure that it meets environmental obligations and helps farmers to make a transition. But I think a rural sector that is more diversified is hugely valuable. It's less troubled by market vagaries. It's more resilient. If we have something like, God help us, foot and mouth or BSE outbreak or similar, we would not decimate rural Ireland in the way we would at the moment.
Catherine?
I think it's also, you know, this idea that it's trees or vegetables or animals. Actually, that's not, that's a very recent idea of agriculture. You know, in living memory, farms were mixed. They had a diverse range of things happening on them. And that is an incredibly healthy way to farm. What the huge problem now for farmers are is not just that the price of the factories, but it's also the price of the inputs that they have to put into their beef, because we're going bigger and faster in beef production. And a large part of that input is the processed foods that we're feeding to animals, which is a part of the beef story that's not really being told.
These are meal soy that's imported from South America, for
Absolutely,
example.
Absolutely, yeah. Made by Devenish, the company that Alice is a director of. So, you know, this is also part of the carbon footprint of the beef industry that the beef industry is not very comfortable right. talking about.
Right, Alice, just briefly on that. This is an argument, it's a charge that's made against farmers. We talk about, the clean green image of grass-fed cattle, and we never tell them that we're also finishing a lot of animals with meal, which, as Catherine says, Devenish are involved in, that is imported from Brazil and America.
Well, I just want to set the record straight. Irish beef is in large part pasture fed. Devenish provides additional electrolytes and specialist feeds to support that, but less than 10% of the input to beef cattle. Devenish is running, now I'm a human health expert.
Yes,
but
in
I
the
work,
Royal College of Surgeons, yeah.
But part of my work with Devenish is to work with people involved in the agriculture and sustainability business. That's what Devenish works in, the One Health area. It is looking to provide the most nutritious food in the most environmentally friendly way. It has a 500-acre research farm, which is the Lighthouse Farm,
yes.
leading the way in County Meath. It is a beef farm. It will be carbon neutral by 2025, okay. well in advance of our commitments.
Okay.
Well, and it'll do that by enhancing soil fertility,
okay.
By enhancing hedge grows, woodlands, and by silvopasture.
Will you still be sourcing animal feed from former rainforest
We'll let Brian come
areas.
In on that.
I suppose,
just
like,
on that general note, we're not going to turn this into a conversation about one company. We're talking about, Catherine's making the point there, about farmers in general in Ireland who are talking about grass-fed beef and dairy.
An important
feed. And never mentioning the fact that a lot of meal is fed to these cattle that's imported.
Well, you know, it's no secret that supplementary feed is used at times when grass is short in demand. But over 90% of the feed in livestock systems in Ireland is grass. And it's in the farmer's best interest to maximise the amount of grass they get into the animal's diet, because that's good for the pocket. And it is good for the environment as well.
But Brian, we've let go of that idea that animals are purely grass-fed. And that is, from a consumer point of view, and from somebody who eats in restaurants where, you know, the quality of that food is taken very, very seriously. The quality of pasture for life, beef and dairy, which is a system which up until very recently was the Irish way of farming, that has been jettisoned in the name of making bigger and faster production levels of both beef and dairy. And I think an awful lot has been lost along the way.
Okay, briefly on that point, I want to go to an ad break.
Supplementary feed, like feed has always been, in times of shortage in terms of grass, feed has always been used. Supplementary feed has always been used in terms, it could have been byproduct from human food, or it could have been imported, a small bit of imported grain as well. And there's a market for that pasture for life. There is definitely a market, but that is a niche. But most farmers, or all farmers, I'd say, are maximising the amount of grass in the cows or any livestock units diet, and that's in their best interests.
Okay, Alice, do you want to say anything on that? Before?
I think Brian is more okay. the expert on agriculture. I've expertise on human health
right.
And on the most nutritious food for humans.
Okay, and we'll continue with that discussion after this break.
You're listening to Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
And you're welcome back. And this morning we're talking about climate action and the role of our diets and food in that. With me in studio, Professor Peter Thorne from NUI Maynooth, Kildare farmer Brian Rush, food writer Catherine Cleary, Professor Alice Stanton, and in our Galway studio, chef and restaurateur JP McMahon. Now, is lab technology going to transform food into the future? Well, Farmany is an indoor growing unit in North Dublin, a hydroponic vertical farm. The company hopes to sell hydroponic food and the technology used to grow it into the Irish market to reduce our food imports and provide more sustainable food. Here's Suzanne Campbell.
I've got my hairnet on, my white coat. We're going into the unit now. It's like a big, white, spacey-looking freezer cabinet.
Yes, so what you see in front of you is a Farmany. Two repurposed 40-foot shipping containers, side by side, fused in the middle to open up basically a grow room, which has a footprint of about 55 square metres. But because we're growing vertically in layers, that gives us a growing surface of about 80 square metres. You see our big sign here. This is a 5-acre Farmany.
Wow.
Gets a lot of attention. In Ireland, with our climate, we grow between May and September. So in a Farmany, because we grow all year round in perfect conditions for the plants, we can have the output equivalent of 5 acres of traditional farmland. So to give you that in figures, that would be like 55,000 heads of lettuce.
It's a big potential.
It is. It take microgreens, so you're looking at about 408 trays of microgreens every 7 to 10 days.
Can we go in and have a look? Danko is going to take me in. You're the grower?
Yes, I'm the head grower here.
Pulling open the big door. Wow. In here is where all the LED lamps are and the trays. I can hear the water filtering in. And what are these?
Here we have coriander microgreens. Mm-hmm. They're used in restaurants. The taste is amazing.
And from start to finish, when did they go in and when will they be finished?
For example, this coriander, it takes only 14 days from seed sowing to harvesting. But then we have some other crops. We have rocket, and you can taste rocket as well. It takes only 7 days from seed sowing to harvesting.
And it's so peppery and spicy. It's really good rocket. What have you on this side?
Basil, sweet Genovese. It can be delivered to a customer as a fully grown plant.
Underneath, because you've lifted the tray, those are the roots coming down, and that's coming into the growing medium, which is the water and the nutrients that it survives on, and obviously the lights are above it.
Yes, we have 4 layers of different crops or same crops. It's a very versatile system. This mix contains all the essential minerals that the plant is using for its growth.
Now, you were in traditional growing horticulture, is that right, before you came to this?
Yes, my background is organic farming, but this is something very exciting. 20 years ago, we were looking at this as not economically viable, but nowadays, with this technology development, this is amazing. We don't have any problems with diseases because we keep the temperature, humidity, and all the other conditions essential to the plants at optimum. There's no spraying because we make perfect conditions for every plant to grow at its best.
Farmany's plan is to sell these units and the software to run them to the Irish marketplace. Food grown hydroponically in the US last year was estimated to be worth $32 billion, with nutritional values similar to soil-grown foods. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but the marriage of tech and food is an obvious one.
Basically, it's a fully automated smart farm. So I have my mobile phone. I could be the other side of the world, speeding up the farm, slowing down the farm remotely. Over the last 8 months, we've been growing cycles over and over of herbs like basil, which we see in front of us, trying to find the optimum output, essentially the best growing conditions for basil. And once we've established that, well, then we have a growing recipe that we can program into our software. And then when you own a Farmany, you would transplant your basil, and then the system would turn on, and then the nutrients are flowed into that module automatically too.
In terms of the customer base for your equipment and for this solution, if you like, what kind of people are they?
Yeah, there's many different channels. For example, corporate campuses. Wellness is so important to corporate campuses and diet that they could have these on site. Educational institutions, culinary, agriculture, in-city centres for large grocery chains, and then possibly more obviously to producers and growers. Farmany committee is here to support and complement Irish producers who can grow between May and September, but perhaps have to watch their business go abroad in the winter where so much produce is being imported.
At the moment, there's a capital grant for investment in horticultural equipment. Can people avail of that?
The Department of Agriculture have a horticultural grant each year. We've got a lot of producers that are coming on board and applying for the horticultural grant for 2020, and that would see this network of Farmany farms throughout the country, which is really exciting. I don't come from a growing background myself. I come from a tech background, and it's really exciting to see the advances that tech can bring to food supply.
We import so much veg in this country, and particularly because we can't grow an awful lot of veg in the winter other than the traditional hard veg, the carrots, the parsnips, the cabbages that we're used to. Is this a solution or part of a solution in terms of food miles and in terms of sustainability and producing more veg at home?
Certainly, we've termed it hyperlocal. This could be right in your backyard. Concepts like farm to fork and farm to table. This is essentially what you're looking at. We can harvest today, walk a couple of metres and have a beautiful fresh salad. We've invited a lot of the chefs out from Dublin City Centre, the top chefs. And you know, when you taste the produce, you know, what you're tasting is highly nutritious, fresh, straight off the plant produce. So you take imports, they're losing their nutritional value over the days that they're travelling to Ireland. Also, this is pesticide-free. It's creating jobs locally. It's certainly a sustainable avenue to go down. Perhaps it's not the only solution, but it's certainly part of the solution of food supply.
That's Suzanne Campbell with the guys there at Farmany. JP McMahon, do you believe that more lab-manufactured or this farm-free food, which George Monbiot called it on his Channel 4 documentary last week, do you think you'll see more of that on your menu in the next decade? And how would that sit in a food-producing country like Ireland?
I suppose I'll try and take the middle ground. I think we have to be careful because with all this technology, I think it needs to be assessed in terms of what it's also doing in terms of if you look at LED lights and you look at all the other things that are being produced in terms of you're looking at climate change and carbon. I do think it's going to happen anyway. I think vertical farming, I have chef friends who are engaged with it in Copenhagen. It does have its benefits in terms of glass houses and size. I would be conscious of who owns this and then the potential for that, because I think large pharmaceutical companies and large companies, the agenda behind this lab grown meat or plant based stuff that is grown in labs is also going to have all the same issues that we have at the moment, and we need a more coherent plan, because it's at the moment it is just a lot of different fragmentary thinking, and I don't think it's going to add up the exact same problems. I think if you replace all of this stuff with what we're eating now, you're going to come up with the same problems.
Yeah, Alice, just on that, what about the nutritional deficiencies which we lose if we cut out meat and dairy? Because I was reading, for example, vitamin B12, reading this in the Guardian a few weeks ago. We lose that if we move away to a completely plant-based diet. And calcium from milk, for example.
Yeah. Meat is rich in bioavailable iron, and it's the only source, or animal source food is the only source for vitamin B12. So they certainly are the big picture items that anyone who is going totally vegan would have to watch and would have to take supplements for. They are very important for adult health, but I think critically they're very important for young health. So the figures are that the data is that countries that have a high intake of meat and dairy compared to those that have a very small intake of meat, the difference in childhood stunting, which is reduced physical growth and reduced brain development in the first 1,000 years of life, including in utero, during pregnancy. Countries that eat very little meat, up to 1 in 3 of their children suffer with childhood stunting, and they go on to perform considerably less well in school, if they get to school, and their employment opportunities and career opportunities are considerably reduced thereafter, and their ability to provide for their families. Right. So therefore you get into a vicious circle. So there are dangers
that,
for...
Does that not have to do with poverty of those countries? Because the meat and dairy intake is directly linked to the income in countries and in households.
There obviously, it's a multifactorial picture. So yes, economy, hygiene and exposure to infections, exposure to toxins, aflatoxins, also could are likely to play a role.
And these however, are the countries that are suffering the most from climate change.
However,
unbreathable air and...
I think you have to look at, so there, that's observational data, and we always, it's very difficult in lifestyle choices to actually find what's actually the causative factor. So we need to look at interventional studies. There's only one really good interventional study which looked at if you gave seven-year-old children in Kenya, if you left them with what they were normally eating, if you gave them a vegetable dish every day during school, if you gave them a vegetable dish plus dairy every day, a vegetable dish plus meat, after five semesters, so almost 2 years, the difference in academic achievement between the ones that got the meat and vegetables versus the controls was 15% on average in across a range of subjects. Clear evidence that the balanced protein of meat, the micronutrients, including iron, B12, selenium, iodine, are really important for brain development, both at a very young age and during school child. So I'm not
undoubtedly, but I mean, it's about sharing of resources.
Yeah. So a more equal distribution.
Right. But Irish dairy is not being given to poor children in Kenya. It's going to rich families in China. That's, you know, that's where
Brian,
the market
do you want
is
to come
at.
In there?
Yeah, just a comment on the vertical farming, and I've seen it and it has a role and it obviously exists because there's a market for it. But I do believe that, you know, there is no replacement for what I would say as, you know, the probably one of the most natural food production systems in the world is the Irish food production system. And there will always be a demand for that, a huge demand for that. And we look, like, farmers have reacted, Irish farmers, to consumer demands in terms of environmental standards and animal welfare standards. And consumers, you know, I would feel there isn't, another debate around this is that if standards increase, we need to see an increase in food prices in order to match those standards.
Peter, just on that, what are you saying there?
Absolutely. There is a need to, I would hate to see Ireland be changed beyond recognition and have no beef and dairy and no sheep. It's about balancing and diversifying so that we have a more resilient, interesting rural economy.
Okay, and it, you know what you're after using there is a word called balance. Absolutely. And I think that is what's needed both in the debate, in the discussion. I hope we were balanced this morning. We'd have people giving out to us from either side now, but that's the way it is. I'd love if we had more time. We will come back to it. I want to thank you all for coming into studio this morning. We only barely touched the surface of this very complex, very important discussion about the future viability of our human health, of the environment, of the planet we live in, and of course of farmer incomes as well. So it's a delicate balancing act that we have to get right and keep all those plates spinning at the same time in the air. But thank you indeed to Brian, to Alice, to JP there in Galway, to Peter and to Catherine for coming in. That's all we have time for this week. Coming up after the 9 News, Playback with Sinead Mooney, Ear to the Ground, RT1 Television on Thursday at 7 p.m. We'll be talking to you the same time next week. Bye-bye and thanks for listening.
You can listen back to today's show on rte.ie/countrywide.